elsewhere. Okay, I replied, I'll think about it. And if you want to continue treatment, come back in about a week. Okay. On my way out of the office, and for the rest of the week, I debated about whether to return. I couldn't detect a difference in my physical or mental condition. Was one visit a fair trial? Probably not. And I hadn't articulated a clearly defined goal. If I'd been trying to get rid of neck pain, for instance, I'd know if acupuncture had made a difference. But did this session contribute to my feelings of general wellness? Not that I noticed. I did some research. Studies on the efficacy of acupuncture aren't very convincing, and they suggest that when it does work, its benefits are largely due to the placebo effect. That being said, placebos are often quite effective, especially for disorders that are largely subjective or involve pain. Well, if I thought I felt better, I did feel better. But I didn't feel better. Just the same. Apart from the scientific view, I considered my own experience. An acupuncture session cost me time and money. If I wanted a boost in general wellness, perhaps I should spend that same money and the time on a massage. I treated myself to massages only when we were on vacation, and I loved them. And studies show that massage lowers stress hormones and boosts immunity. Getting more massages would not only be helpful, it would be a great treat. Or I could spend the time on exercise. Exercise always boosts my mood and is a key to good health. I wasn't sure about acupuncture, but I knew that massage or exercise would make me happier. I was glad that I had tried acupuncture because I'd always been curious about it. And maybe it worked for other people in other circumstances. But for me, one visit was enough. At the end of the month, as I was reading yet another article about happiness, I encountered a familiar and influential line of argument, that happiness isn't a goal that can be directly pursued, but rather is the indirect consequence of a life well lived. This position has many esteemed proponents, such as George Orwell, who wrote, "Men can only be happy when they do not assume that the object of life is happiness." And John Stuart Mill, who wrote, "Ask yourself whether you are happy, and you cease to be so." And Aldous Huxley, who wrote, "Happiness is not achieved by the conscious pursuit of happiness. It is generally the byproduct of other activities." And an unknown author, often said to be Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote, "Happiness is a butterfly, which when pursued is always beyond your grasp, but if you will sit down quietly, may alight upon you." But, as audacious as it may be to contradict such venerable figures, I heartily disagree. Whenever anyone raised this argument with me, I argued back. How do you directly pursue happiness, I'd ask, that's different from pursuing it indirectly? One person responded, "I never strive directly for happiness. Instead, I seek accomplishment and meaning, and that gives me satisfaction. Or in a pinch, really vigorous exercise." "Yes," I answered, "those are exactly the kind of activities that would be undertaken by a person aiming directly at happiness." Another person argued, "Leading a pleasure-driven, instant gratification, consumerist life doesn't build happiness." "Right," I said. "But does anyone seriously argue that leading a life of constant indulgence leads to happiness?" "True, some people choose to live that way, but not because they've mindfully decided that it's the path to enduring happiness. Even advertisers hawking pleasure-driven instant gratification purchases tie their products to deeper values. The ad for expensive bath salts appeals to notions of health and serenity. The cell phone ad promises that we'll grow closer to friends and family. The car ad invokes safety and reliability, or, contrarywise, freedom and adventure. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "Happiness is not a goal. It is a byproduct." But that's a false choice. Happiness is a goal and a byproduct. The activities a person would undertake to pursue happiness directly are identical to the activities that would yield happiness indirectly. Helping others, finding engaging work, building close ties to other people, going for a run, finding opportunities for fun and challenge, clearing out the garage. In what ways would these two paths differ? In the area of happiness, false choices seem particularly alluring. One reader wrote to me, The question is whether I risk everything to find true happiness or keep my job and continue feeling blah. I thought, were those really the only two options? False choices are tempting. Instead of facing an intimidating array of options, we face a few simple possibilities. I can have a few close friends or a bunch of superficial relationships. I have to marry this person now or accept the fact that I'm never going to have a family. I can work toward my own happiness or other people's happiness. It's more important to be authentic and honest than it is to be positive and enthusiastic. I can have an interesting life or a happy life. If I don't want to live in a chaotic, clutter-filled house, I need to get rid of all my stuff. But although false choices can be comforting, they can leave us feeling trapped and blinded to other possibilities. We're more likely to hit a target by aiming at it than by ignoring it, and happiness is no different. In his strange, thrilling novel about happiness, A Landing on the Sun, Michael Frayn wrote, "The idea of happiness is surely the sun at the center of our conceptual planetary system and has proved just as hard to look at directly. At least in my case, I found that thinking directly about how to be happier helped me to discover the changes likely to build happiness." The month of March. Family. Hold more tightly. He was like a man owning a piece of ground in which, unknown to himself, a treasure lay buried. You would not call such a man rich. Neither would I call happy the man who is so, without realizing it. Eugène Delacroix, Journal. Resolutions. Follow a threshold ritual. Have an uncomfortable conversation with my parents. Plan a nice little surprise. Collaborate with my sister. The first day of March was a sharp reminder to appreciate my family and this time of life. Eleanor's kindergarten class celebrated 100 Day on the 100th day of school. Kindergarten was slipping by so quickly. To me, the school year still felt new. Jamie and I visited the classroom to view the Hundreds Museum, which displayed each child's exhibit of 100 objects. "Jamie, look," I said, pointing. "Here's Eleanor's collection. Beads. Look at her sign." She'd carefully written a label for her work, loaded with misspellings. It read, "I collected 100 beads. I made 10 groups of 10. Eleanor." Of everything in my life, my relationship with my family is the most important element to my happiness. Jamie, Eliza, and Eleanor are daily influences, but my family extends beyond those three. I've always been close to my parents, Karen and Jack Kraft. Even now that I live in New York, far from Kansas City, they're a constant source of reassurance and good counsel, which is lucky for me because I've always been disproportionately swayed by their advice. Some of the best advice from my mother? Stay calm. And the things that go wrong often make the best memories. And Gretchen does better with a few things she really likes instead of a lot of choices. From my father, if you're willing to take the blame when you deserve it, people will give you the responsibility. And enjoy the process. And energy. I love going home to Kansas City, and I love having them visit New York. My in-laws, Judy and Bob Rubin, also play a big role in my life. I've always gotten along with Jamie's parents very well, which is fortunate because I see one or both of them at least once a week. In addition to frequent family plans, I also often spot them walking in the neighborhood or at the gym where we all go for weekly strength training. I'd converted Jamie, Judy, and Bob to the Inform Fitness gym. In fact, the owner joked that it should be called Rubinform Fitness because some member of our family always seems to be there. In the middle of an arm pull-down, I'd look across the room and realize that the man in the black shorts at the leg press was my father-in-law. I'd been interested to learn from my research that Jamie and I had made it safely through two of the three most significant stress points in a relationship between a person and a spouse's family. When a couple first marries and the families join together, at the birth of the first child, and when an in-law or other family member falls ill or needs to be cared for. My relationship with my younger sister, Elizabeth Kraft Fierro, or Liz, as almost everyone outside our family calls her, is also one of the most important relationships in my life. She, her husband Adam, and their one-year-old son Jack live far away in Los Angeles, so I don't get to see her nearly as often as I'd like. Since Kansas City, Elizabeth and I have never lived in the same place. Sibling relationships aren't studied as rigorously as relations with parents, children, or spouses, but for many people, their relationships with their siblings are their longest lasting. In one study, college women reported getting as much emotional support from their closest sister or brother as from their mother. I'd long thought of myself as having the personality of a typical first child, and Elizabeth the typical second child, but despite widespread beliefs about the role of birth order in determining adult character, studies show that while it matters within a family, there's little evidence of a connection between birth order and personality type. My research did reveal an interesting note about sisters. In general, people who have sisters tend to be happier. Jamie's brother Phil is the same age as Elizabeth, and although he doesn't live around the corner the way Jamie's parents do, he's just downtown with his wife Lauren and their 3-year-old son Henry. Eliza and Eleanor love having a cousin nearby, and often remark, whenever they catch sight of anything related to Elmo or Buzz Lightyear, "Wow, Henry would love that." One small but not insignificant source of happiness in my life was that Phil and Lauren, who met in culinary school, always wanted to host the big family Thanksgiving dinner. I was permanently off the hook. For the month of March, I wanted to take steps to strengthen my already strong bonds to my family. To remind myself to appreciate my immediate family and this time of life, I would follow a threshold ritual. In a very different kind of gratitude exercise, I resolved to have an uncomfortable conversation with my parents about issues such as healthcare proxies and living wills. I was thankful that both my parents were in great health, and if anything, their lives seemed fuller and more hectic than ever before, so this discussion didn't seem urgent. But I knew that we'd find it much easier to have that conversation if we did it now. In addition to tackling that unpleasant task, I wanted to add more enjoyable moments of family engagement, so I resolved to plan a nice little surprise. And for many years, I'd wanted to work with my sister on some kind of creative project. Nothing would be more fun than that, and it would be a wonderful way to draw closer to her. I resolved to find a way to collaborate with my sister. Follow a threshold ritual. Gratitude is a key to a happy life. People who cultivate gratitude get a boost in happiness and optimism, feel more connected to others, are better liked and have more friends, and are more likely to help others. They even sleep better and have fewer headaches. Also, when I consider my reasons to be grateful, I'm less touchy. Grateful feelings crowd out negative emotions such as anger, envy, and resentment. Although I wanted a sense of thankfulness to permeate the atmosphere of my home, I found it challenging to cultivate gratitude. It was too easy to fail to appreciate all the things I'm grateful for, from pervasive basic things, such as democratic government and running water, to major personal aspects of my life, such as the fact that my family was in good health, and that our beloved babysitter Ashley was so cheerful and full of fun, to little passing joys, such as a surprisingly fast-moving line at the copy store. Most of all, I was grateful for my family. The days are long, but the years are short, and I knew that this time that seems so long, Jamie and I, with our girls, all under the same roof, with hair bands and colored pencils underfoot, and the sound of Jim Dale reading Harry Potter constantly in the background, will actually be just a short period over the course of my life. It seemed as though Eliza had just arrived, but before I knew it, Eleanor would be moving out. I wanted to notice the quality of this time and appreciate it. Sometimes I felt annoyed by the half-finished friendship bracelets that turned up everywhere, or the brightly colored plastic slide standing outside our kitchen, but one day, I'd be wistful at the thought of these days. My fourth splendid truth holds that I'm not happy unless I think I'm happy, a precept that artist Eugène Delacroix captured in a powerful analogy. He was like a man owning a piece of ground in which, unknown to himself, a treasure lay buried. You would not call such a man rich. Neither would I call happy the man who is so without realizing it. I had my treasure, but it was all too easy to overlook it, to walk over it without realizing it, without appreciating how happy I was. To remind myself to feel grateful for everything I had and for my dear ordinary life, I decided to follow a threshold ritual. Each time I stood at the top of the steps, as I fumbled for my keys to turn off the alarm and unlock the two front doors of our building, I repeated, "How happy I am, how grateful I am to be home." Every time I crossed the threshold from the street into my building, I took a moment to reflect lovingly on my family. I love the United States and I love New York City. I love my neighborhood and I love my building. In fact, when I asked myself, if I moved someplace else, where would I want to live? I realized that I wouldn't want to move even 5 blocks in any direction. I'm right where I want to be. Despite the usual problems with recurrent leaks, plugged toilets, and occasional appliance failures, my home feels safe, solid, and secure, a tremendous source of happiness. I could recall many famous accounts of mourning the loss of a home. Isak Dinesen losing her beloved coffee farm in Kenya because of financial troubles. The forced sale of Lubov Andreevna's house and orchard in Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. The slow, empty decay of the abandoned house in Virginia Woolf's novel To the Lighthouse. Vida Sackville-West's sorrow at losing her family's magnificent country house, Knoll, under the laws of male primogeniture, the terrible fire that destroyed Louis Comfort Tiffany's masterpiece, Laurelton Hall, the murders and fire that destroyed Frank Lloyd Wright's home and studio, Taliesin, and the second fire that destroyed Taliesin too. One day, gladly or reluctantly, I would leave my apartment behind, and the anticipation of this departure made me love it more. Along with this threshold ritual, I looked for other ways to cultivate a thankful frame of mind. For instance, about money. Money, like health, affects happiness mostly in the negative. It's easy to take it for granted unless you don't have it, and then it can become a major source of unhappiness. We had enough money to feel safe, with our walls strong around us, and this feeling of security was one of the greatest luxuries that money could buy. To remember this major contributor to my daily happiness, every time I sat down for another session with my checkbook and a big stack of household bills, I thought, how happy I am to be able to pay these bills, instead of thinking, what a drag to sit down and pay bills. I had an opportunity for gratitude on March 16th, the night before St. Patrick's Day. I was exhausted, and I didn't really feel like setting the table for a holiday breakfast, but I'd made the resolution to celebrate holiday breakfasts. I admonished myself, I'm so grateful to have 2 girls who are still young enough to be excited by a green breakfast. Once the girls were in bed, I put out the green plates I'd bought. I scattered some green candy across the table, dyed a cup of milk green to put on Eliza's cereal, and made a batch of green peanut butter, a peculiar and not very appetizing sight, for Eleanor's toast. "Happy St. Patrick's Day," I sang out as the girls came into the kitchen the next morning. Jamie was out of town, so I took a photo of the girls smiling over their green food to email to him and the grandparents. Now, like most traditions, this effort was a bit of a pain. It involved errands and organization. I had to wait until the girls were asleep to set the table at a time when I felt like collapsing myself. But it didn't take much to make a breakfast feel festive, and it certainly boosted my happiness and my appreciation for an ordinary day. In the tumult of daily life, it's so hard really to see the everyday, to realize how precious it is every time I cross the threshold. The sculptor Alberto Giacometti wrote, "Everything gains in grandeur every day, becomes more and more unknown, more and more beautiful. The closer I come, the grander it is, the more remote it is. The more I think about happiness, the more I feel it." have an uncomfortable conversation with my parents. One of my favorite paradoxes of happiness? Happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. Often my happiness is best served by undertakings that make me feel anxious, uneasy, frustrated, or stupid. But as English essayist Joseph Addison observed, the important question is not what will yield to man a few scattered pleasures, but what will render his life happy on the whole amount. For example, when Jamie and I had finally sat down to write our wills, we both felt uncomfortable. It's not a fun exercise, but in the end, I felt happier knowing that we'd done it. Now I wanted to tackle a similar task with my parents. The next time we were all together, drinking coffee in the kitchen of my parents' apartment, I gingerly introduced the subject. Have you two ever filled out those forms for financial power of attorney, medical power of attorney, living wills, whatever they're called in Missouri? Maybe it would be a good idea to do all that. I think we did it, didn't we? My mother asked my father. But it's been several years. Maybe 10 years. Yes, my father answered, looking thoughtful. We did something. But where are the forms? My mother asked my father. At your office? I think so. Well, I suggested, if it's been a while, maybe you should check. In the meantime, I did some research. Because different states have different terminology and requirements, the forms are confusing. But the website www.compassionandchoices.org, under the heading Care and Advanced Directives/Living Wills, provided every state's documents for advanced directives for healthcare. I poked around a bit more on the subject of financial powers of attorney, then emailed my parents. Hey, remember we talked about those health forms, etc.? Did you find out if you already did them? For Missouri, you probably want the Missouri Declaration, like a living will, and the Durable Power of Attorney for healthcare. Declaration requires you to sign with two witnesses, and the power of attorney has to be notarized. Also, you may want the Durable Financial Power of Attorney, which, if I recall, you thought you had not done before. Not sure what's needed there for witnesses, etc. Not exciting stuff, and what a pain to get a notary and witnesses, but good to get this done. Thinking along these lines prompted me to send my mother another email. It occurs to me that it would be handy to have a list of what medicines you and Dad take, and your doctor's names and numbers, just to have it all in one place. I'm making a list for Jamie and me. If you make one, would you send me a copy? It didn't make me happy to have these conversations, but it didn't make me unhappy. When Jamie and I wrote our wills, I'd been consoled by the irrational yet cheering illusion that these were imaginary documents that would never actually matter. Similarly, with my parents, it was easier to have this conversation when it seemed purely abstract. Also, my mother and father were game to talk about these issues. Some people refused to broach any conversation related to illness, incapacity, or death. And the fact that we could readily talk about these topics made the conversations much less stressful. We also had it easy because we shared the same values and we all got along well. These kinds of discussions are more difficult when family members have very different viewpoints or when there is a history of strife. However, although my parents were willing to discuss these topics, actually getting the forms completed would be tiresome, so I appointed myself the family nudge. In the long term, completing this process would make all of us happier. I wondered if I should also be nudging my in-laws. I raised the issue with Jamie one night while we were reading in bed. "Put down your book for a second," I said, giving him a knock. Jamie put down his book. I talked to my parents about durable powers of attorney, advanced directives, that sort of thing. Should we talk to your parents about it? No, he said without hesitation. Should I talk to them about it? I will if you want. Definitely not. I let the matter drop. Jamie was the final judge of how to deal with his parents. Thinking about unpleasant conversations with my parents reminded me of the importance of pleasant conversations with my family. I dislike talking on the phone, so it's always an effort to make a call. But the more often I speak with my family, the happier I feel. I should call and email and visit and send photos with my parents, my in-laws, my sister, and even Jamie. It isn't enough to love. I must prove it. plan a nice little surprise. I'd been intrigued by studies showing that we react more strongly to an unexpected pleasure than to an expected one. The brain gets a bigger thrill when some little treat comes as a surprise, whether it's a dollar found in the street, a free cookie sample, a gift for no reason, or an unexpected compliment from a boss. And not only do we feel happier, but these little boosts of happiness also make us temporarily smarter, friendlier, and more productive. I loved a surprise treat. Every once in a while, Jamie brings home my favorite lentil soup, or even better, stops by the frozen yogurt store I love to bring home a container of Tasty Delight. I love Tasty Delight so much and had been eating it so often that I'd had to give it up entirely. However, though I abstained from buying it myself, I did eat it when Jamie bought it for me, a system that makes sense to an abstainer. Jamie also likes to surprise us with unexpected outings. Recently, he'd taken us for our first family dinner of Korean barbecue. I wanted to contribute to an atmosphere of thoughtfulness and delight. I resolved to plan a nice little surprise for the members of my family. When Eliza was in nursery school, we lived near a bakery that sold tiny cupcakes. Every once in a while, I'd bring one home and announce, "We're going to practice your birthday." I'd turn out the lights, put a candle in the cupcake, light it, sing happy birthday, and let her blow it out. She was thrilled by her practice birthdays. I'd do it now, except that that beloved bakery is gone, and the bakeries near our apartment make cupcakes that are as big as a head of lettuce. I resolved to see if I could find a source for mini cupcakes, and once I really started looking, I found a place near the girls' school. "I have a surprise for dessert tonight," I told them after dinner. "What?" Eliza asked. "Go into the other room for a minute." I put a candle in each rainbow-sprinkled little cupcake, lit both, and turned off the light. "Come in," I called. Then I started singing, "Happy unbirthday to you." The girls were delighted. What else? Eleanor loved it when I surprised her with a new audiobook from the library. Jamie loved it when I did a deep tidy-up. I noticed a $12 necklace rack on sale, so I picked it up for Eliza, who loves to reorganize her jewelry. What nice little surprises could I plan for my parents and in-laws? I knew that they loved any updates about the girls, so I made a bigger effort to report after a teacher's conference or doctor's appointment and to pass along particularly funny or sweet remarks, such as Eliza recently admitting that she'd always thought Stephen Sondheim's name was Stephen Songtime. In particular, now that I was free from the oppression of my digital photos, I took more photos, and I made a point of emailing them to family members. When Eleanor struck poses in her new gymnastics leotard, or when Eliza modeled the chiton that the Lucky for Me arts and craftsy Judy had sewed for the 6th grade Greek festival, I took a photo and emailed it to Jamie and the grandparents. One night, I heard a knock on my office door and turned to see Eleanor. "What are you doing up?" I asked with surprise. "You went to bed almost an hour ago." "This is the most exciting night of my life," Eleanor said, shaking with exhilaration. "My tooth is loose." I was in bed, and I was pressing on it, and all of a sudden, I felt it move. At first, I wasn't sure if it really was loose, but it is. "Wow," I answered. "Let me see." She obediently wiggled her lower front tooth for me. "Let me take a picture for your grandparents." I took the picture, emailed it, then tucked her back into bed. But 30 minutes later, she popped back into our bedroom to show off the tooth to Jamie and me. "Look, now it's looser," she exclaimed. "When I press on it, I get little jolts of hurting." She was so excited that I said, "Do you want to call Grandma and Grandpa and Bunny and Grandpa Jack to tell them?" "You can, but you can only talk for a little while, and then you really have to go to sleep." Although Eleanor rarely agrees to talk on the phone, she nodded eagerly. "I really wish I'd thought to videotape her," I said to Jamie as she chattered away. Her excitement, her high piping voice, that very first tooth. I wanted never to forget this. When Eleanor's tooth did pop out a few days later, I sent the grandparents an email with the subject line, "Tooth Fairy," with a photo of her grinning into the camera and proudly pointing to the new gap in her teeth. My father emailed me back. "Yesterday, I also had a tooth out. which required a lot more than a tooth fairy. As I planned these nice little surprises, it occurred to me that the opposite of a profound truth is also true, and anticipation, as well as surprise, is an important element of happiness. Jamie loves to cook, so I considered buying him a selection of Indian spices. Then I decided, no. Jamie enjoys making trips to specialty grocery stores and picking out unusual ingredients himself, so I should think of a different little surprise for him. I ended up buying him a set of Bucky Balls, the desk toy made of little magnetic balls that had been a fad among Eliza's friends. Jamie incessantly fiddles with things when he works, so I bought him a set to play with, and he loved it. Yet again, I saw the effect of the resolution to act the way I want to feel. By acting in a thoughtful, loving way, I boosted my feelings of tenderness toward my family, and that contributed more to the happiness of our home than anything else I could do. Collaborate with my sister. Although my sister Elizabeth is 5 years younger than I am, she has always had a powerful influence on me. For instance, she proved a person's ability to make a radical change. In one night, I remember it vividly, she transformed her entire life. We were in our 20s, both in Kansas City for Christmas, and at that time, Elizabeth was living in a great apartment in Greenwich Village and writing and editing young adult novels. On the night before Christmas Eve, Elizabeth went to a bar where she ran into an old friend, Sarah Fain. Sarah told her, "I'm moving to Los Angeles to write screenplays." Over the first beer, Elizabeth promised, "I'll come visit you for a few weeks." And by the third beer, she said, "I'm moving to LA too." On Christmas Eve morning, Elizabeth told us that she wanted to try TV writing and was seriously considering moving. By February 8th, she'd made up her mind, packed up her New York apartment, with a lot of 11th hour help from my mother, moved to Los Angeles, settled in a little house in Ocean Park with Sarah, and was figuring out how to become a TV writer. That was a major happiness project style undertaking. When I was considering switching from law to writing, the fact that Elizabeth was a working writer helped me to envision making the jump myself. But while Elizabeth had always been a confidant and a model for me, and our relationship was one of the most important in my life, I didn't see or talk to her as much as I would have liked. She and Adam had a new baby, the delightful Jack, and I had two children. We both worked full-time. We were separated by the 3-hour time difference and the 6-hour flight between New York City and Los Angeles. In particular, I'd always wanted to collaborate with Elizabeth on some project. But what? Although we were both writers, we were very different types of writers. She was a storyteller, a writer of TV scripts and novels. Even after she'd made the switch to TV, she and Sarah had written 2 excellent young adult novels, while I loved to do research and write nonfiction. Still, I wished we could do something together. "Let's get a radio show," I told her, only half joking, "like the 5 Satellite Sisters. Or maybe we should do a video show on YouTube, like the Vlog Brothers." "I'd love that. What would we talk about?" "Oh, our own brilliant insights. I don't know. Maybe we could talk about children's literature. We both love that. Or let's write something together." I was always looking for ways to collaborate with other people. For instance, working with my friend to create the book 4 to Llewellyn's Edge had taken 2 years, a lot of planning, many eBay purchases, and a huge amount of work, and it had been thrilling. I wished Elizabeth and I could collaborate, but I couldn't envision exactly what our project could be. Then, in an unexpected way, an opportunity arose. In December, I'd hosted the 2nd annual Tri-Kidlit Party, the holiday party for the 3 children's and young adult literature reading groups to which I belonged. I loved each of these 3 groups, and I wanted to introduce all the members to one another. At the party, I saw Daniel Ehrenhaft, one of the earliest Kidlit members. I knew Dan through Elizabeth. They'd been friends in college and had worked together as writers. Dan still worked in YA publishing and had written several YA novels himself. I knew Dan was always looking for new ideas, and I cornered him at the party. "I have the greatest idea for a young adult trilogy," I told him. "I'm serious. This is genius. What? Asked Dan, laughing. I've been intrigued by this subject my whole life, the Eleusinian Mysteries, a secret initiation rite celebrated in ancient Greece. It was celebrated for 2,000 years, and no one ever told the secret of the mysteries. What were the secrets? No one knows. Eleusis was one of the holiest places in Greece, and the Eleusinian Mysteries, sacred rites in honor of Demeter and Persephone, drew participants from all over the ancient world. Everyone. Men, women, slaves, emperors, poets, philosophers. It was a 9-day initiation, and it culminated in the revelation of a great secret. But here's the thing. Despite the fact that so many people participated for so many hundreds of years, its secrets were never betrayed. We only know scraps. Hints like, whatever happened involved things recited, things shown, and things performed. That sounds pretty interesting, Dan said. I'll check it out. The next day, I sent Dan the link to the Wikipedia entry. A few days later, I heard back from him. I just read about the Eleusinian Mysteries. Honestly, this could be the natural YA paranormal slash romance successor for all the kids, girls and boys, who grew up on Percy Jackson and Harry Potter. It could be a romantic YA thriller partially in the vein of The Da Vinci Code, but also alternating between past and present, involving a secret, romantic, dangerous, and magic world that's existed for thousands of years without our knowing. If you're game, I'd love to talk to you about this sooner rather than later. Your overly excited friend, Dan. Before answering, I emailed my sister. I've been doing a lot of reading about the Greek religion lately, and I'm very intrigued with the Eleusinian Mysteries. 2,000 years, no one has ever known the secret. Nothing. No one broke the secret. I mentioned this to Dan E. when I saw him Tuesday night at our annual Tri-Kidlit party and sent him the link because I thought it would make a great basis for a YA series. Enough history is known to make it seem real and rooted in actual reality, but huge scope for the imagination, as Anne of Green Gables would say. Apparently, he agrees. I don't have the chops to write this, but you do. Any interest? I do think it is a very rich idea. The Wikipedia entry doesn't do justice to the crazy Eleusis stuff. For example, the name of the town Eleusis means arrival. How thrilling is that? Any interest? I would love to see what you would do with this. Elizabeth called me. I'm in! Really? You really want to try to do something with this idea? Absolutely. Let's work on it together. I was thrilled. A way to collaborate with Elizabeth on such a fascinating subject. Then the work began. Dan started the process by sending out a few pages that sketched out the bones of a story, and slowly we began to elaborate on the characters and the plot. While most novels are written by a single author, many other models exist as well. At the end of one of our conversations, I said, I'm so excited about this. I have to read a quotation to evoke that Eleusinian mood. I love quotations. Let's hear it, Elizabeth and Dan said together. I cleared my voice dramatically. It's from Seneca. There are holy things that are not communicated all at once. Eleusis always keeps something back to show those who come again. It still gives me a chill every time I read it. Over the next several months, we built on the story. Sometimes the three of us, sometimes just Elizabeth and me. Was the story from a first-person perspective or third-person? What exactly was happening in the part of the story set in ancient Greece, and when? As we worked, certain elements began to become clearer. In the contemporary story, the family runs one of the biggest casinos in Las Vegas. In ancient Greece, a central character was born a slave. Elizabeth was doing the hardest work, actually writing those first chapters, but I had a role to play too. I could edit and help brainstorm, and I love research. While Elizabeth worked on the difficult issues of character and plot, I dug into the history and mythology of the Eleusinian Mysteries. At one point, I admit, I lost heart. We've all said those familiar words. If I'd known how much work would be involved, I'm not sure I would have started. Often, when I have an idea for a creative undertaking, It seems straightforward and fun. But as I dig deeper, I realize how much time, energy, and effort will be required to carry through. It's hard to do even simple things well, and most things aren't simple. As it became clear how much work Eleusis, or whatever we would call it, another critical question, would demand, even from me, I felt overwhelmed. I would be doing just one small part, but was even that contribution too great a responsibility and distraction? Maybe I should drop out and focus my energies on my own work. I was so busy. I already had too much to do. Keep it simple. No. Bigger. I have plenty of time to do the things that are important to me. Pouring out ideas is better for creativity than doling them out by the teaspoon. Instead of brooding about the gigantic amount of work needed to complete the entire project, I thought about the work needed to be finished by me this month. That seemed manageable. And I loved working with my sister. We'd call each other and abruptly launch into shorthand talk that drew on themes and techniques from other books or movies we loved. Not to keep bringing it up, but again, she's like Michael in The Godfather. And, have you read The Passage yet? And, I've got to reread The Magus. And, the thing is, pomegranates are really associated with Persephone. Demeter is all about the grain. And, the secret history, the source of the power. And, stay with me here, but what about a kind of Sound of Music escape? And listen to this from Carl Jung. There is no better means of intensifying the treasured feeling of individuality than the possession of a secret which the individual is pledged to guard. The very beginnings of societal structures reveal the craving for secret organizations. When no valid secrets really exist, mysteries are invented or contrived to which privileged initiates are admitted. Right? After reading Carl Karenia's Eleusis, Archetypal Image of Mother and Daughter, I sent an email to Elizabeth and Dan. I have just one word for you. Pigs. Mystical pigs. So what's the deal with the pigs? Elizabeth asked the next time we spoke. Pigs are very important, was all I would say. Mystical pigs. Just wait. I'm pulling together some information for you. Soon I'd gathered a tall stack of books from which to pull the rich details that could feed a novelist's imagination. Mystery Cults of the Ancient World. A History of Religious Ideas, Volumes 1 and 2. Homo Nicans. Man the Killer. I especially loved that book. The Complete World of Greek Mythology. The Ancient Mysteries, a Sourcebook of Sacred Texts. Eleusis and the Eleusinian Mysteries. The Homeric Hymn to Demeter. I pulled together a packet of some of the most helpful material and mailed it out, and I also sent Elizabeth some books of the everyday life in ancient Greece type to help her anchor her story in history. Not long after that, one exciting day, an email from Elizabeth popped up in my inbox. Hey, here are a few pages. Really, only the first three of the book proper. There are a couple title pages for ego-boosting padding. But this was a complete scene, so I figured it was good to send. Next scene will be them going to the vault. Be brutal. I have a very thick skin. Nothing you can say will bother me. I just want to get it right, which is why I'm sending now. Just give me your gut reaction. Don't worry about line edits. Thanks. It was thrilling to see the page with the words Eleusis, the unspeakable act, as we were currently calling it, slide out from my printer. Elizabeth had started to spin a real story, and I saw how good it would be. There was an immense distance to cover, but the long labor was well begun at last. Not long after, I got another email from Elizabeth, who was spending a family weekend in Las Vegas. Grain decorations at the casino restaurant. A sign. Demeter. She's all about the grain. The thing is, I'm not going to be able to work very fast, she reminded me. I have my day job, too. We're not in any rush, I answered. It's a secret of adulthood. People tend to overestimate what can be done in the short term and underestimate what can be done in the long term a little bit each day. Let's keep it fun. But then I thought of my irritating, if well-intended, whip-cracking tendencies. "Do you want me to bug you about it?" I asked. "I can be a bit relentless, but if you want me to badger you a little, I will. I do want accountability. Let's plan that I'll email you with new material each week. You can remind me." "I promise not to nag," I said. A promise more to myself than to her. And so the project started in earnest. It was hard to know exactly how it would proceed, but it had begun. As the first splendid truth makes clear, the feeling of growth and movement toward a goal is very important to happiness, just as important, and perhaps more important, than finally reaching that goal. Nietzsche captured this tension. The end of a melody is not its goal, but nonetheless, if the melody had not reached its end, it would not have reached its goal either. A parable. While some more passive forms of leisure, such as watching TV or surfing the internet, are fun in the short term, over time, they don't offer nearly the same happiness as more challenging activities, such as becoming an expert on the Eleusinian mysteries or editing the draft of a chapter. I was extremely lucky. It was my job to learn and to write, and I had tremendous freedom every day to decide what to do and how to do it. Yet even for me, the more room I found in my life for choosing projects that I truly loved and working toward them, the happier I became. I'd expected to enjoy collaborating with my sister, and I certainly did, but I also found that just talking to her more often made a big difference. Now that we had a particular reason to call, we talked more. And no surprise, I felt closer to her. We were so interested in the project that we barely took the time to talk about anything else, and I wasn't up to date on the plans for her kitchen renovation or on her latest meetings with studio executives. And we talked only a short time about Jack's latest cute exploits, but it didn't matter. "It's really terrific, the way it worked out for you to work with Elizabeth," commented a friend who knows us both, "and how crazy that your kidlit groups turned into a professional opportunity, and with her. It's almost too good to be true." "Yes," I said slowly, "it did seem almost magical. How had I been so lucky for everything to work out so neatly?" As I thought back, I realized the secret. Be Gretchen. As part of my first happiness project, in an effort to embrace my true nature and my real passions, I'd started my kidlit group. Without that decision, I wouldn't have had a reason to see Dan. I wouldn't have been thinking so much about children's literature. I wouldn't have seen the creative possibilities in the Eleusinian mysteries, and I wouldn't have had the opportunity to work with Elizabeth. How appropriate for someone now obsessed with the religion of ancient Greece that the admonition to know thyself is inscribed on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. Be Gretchen. At the end of March, we went on our annual spring break beach trip with my in-laws. "Are you dreading it, having to go on vacation with your in-laws?" a friend asked before we left. "No," I answered, surprised. "It's great, especially with the girls. My mother-in-law loves to build sandcastles, look for shells, read aloud, reenact Swan Lake in the swimming pool, and generally mess around, as she calls it, with Eliza and Eleanor. My father-in-law doesn't actually build sandcastles, but he enjoys hanging around the action. That means that along with family time, Jamie and I also get a chance to go to the gym, take a nap, or do a little work if we want. Fun for the whole family." "You've been on a trip with them before?" "Oh, sure. We go on a trip with Jamie's parents every spring break, and we take another little trip with them over Labor Day weekend. And we visit my parents for a week at Christmas and a week in August." "I can't even imagine that," she said with a shudder. "For me, that kind of intense family time would be hell." This conversation reminded me, again, how fortunate I was. Just as I shouldn't take my family's good health for granted, I shouldn't take the harmony, mostly, of our relationships for granted. While on vacation, I used myself as a guinea pig to test the conclusion of some interesting studies. According to this research, interrupting a pleasant experience with something less pleasant can intensify a person's overall pleasure. For example, surprisingly, commercials make TV watching more fun, and interrupting a massage heightens the pleasure it gives. For my own version of the experiment, along with my vacation pleasure reading, I brought several long articles. They'd been sitting on my shelf, cluttering up my precious surface space and weighing on my mind for months. If I sat down with them, I could probably read the entire stack in a few hours, but I'd never managed to make myself do that. I brought the papers on vacation, and every day I read one. And, as the studies predicted, this small, daily, irksome task made vacation more fun. Having a little chore amplified my general feeling of leisure. When I was reading for fun, it felt more fun. Also, tackling this work made me feel virtuous and productive, and gave me a sense of accomplishment that far outweighed the actual work I was doing. Gold stars. This year, the last day of our trip fell on April Fool's Day, which meant an opportunity to celebrate a variation of a holiday breakfast. Because we weren't at home, I had to come up with a plan that didn't involve my standby prank prop, food coloring. I walked into the girls' room as they were waking up. "Listen, guys, I have something to tell you," I said in a serious voice. "The hotel just dropped off an important note." I held up an envelope that I'd retrieved from the trash to lend some credibility to my announcement. "They've discovered something in the water that might not be healthy, so no one is supposed to go swimming today." "At the beach or in the pool?" asked Eliza. "Well, neither. They think people might be able to use the pool tomorrow, but we'll be gone. I'm really sorry about this." Eliza suddenly got a suspicious look on her face. "I don't believe you," she said. "Look at the letter," I said, handing it to her. "What's in the water?" Eleanor asked in a mournful voice. "Some kind of bacteria." "Wow, this is terrible," said Eliza, pretending to read the letter. I couldn't believe it. Eliza was playing along with me. "What a drag. We can't swim all day." "That's okay, Mommy," said Eleanor bravely. "We can do other things." Protests I could stand, but not that downcast little face. I couldn't keep up the joke. "April Fools!" I yelled. "Really?" said Eleanor. "It's just a joke? We can swim?" "I really believed you at first," said Eliza. "It was a real April Fool's trick?" asked Eleanor. "I want to go tell Grandma and Grandpa." I had them do a reenactment so I could take a photo. We had a wonderful time on the trip, with a minimum of whining or complaining from children or adults. On the way home, I listed the secrets of adulthood that came in handy during a family vacation. Less is more. Start early if possible. When packing an item that might leak, put it in a plastic bag. Don't let anyone get too hungry, especially me. Cheerfulness is contagious, and crabbiness is even more contagious. Wear sunscreen. Carry tissues. Remind kids to visit the bathroom. Don't wait for the thought to occur to them. Get plenty of sleep. There's joy in routine, but an occasional disruption makes routine all the sweeter. Make it easy to do right and hard to go wrong. Quit while you're ahead. Make each of my children helpless with laughter at least once each day. Doing a little work makes goofing off more fun. The things that go wrong often make the best memories. If possible, return on Saturday for a day at home before the regular routine starts. Leave plenty of room in the suitcase. As Eisenhower observed, plans are worthless, but planning is everything. The point is to have fun. Back in New York City, as we dragged our suitcases off the service elevator, I thought once again of one of the simplest and most obvious secrets of adulthood. There's no place like home. The first day that I was back at my desk after vacation, I spoke on the phone with a reporter who was writing a piece about happiness. 1 minute into the conversation, I could tell he came from the "happiness is overrated, selfish, and probably illusory" camp. Or, perhaps, from the people would be more authentically fulfilled if they weren't brainwashed into pursuing this smiley face of happiness camp. And a happiness leech, certainly. In an accusatory tone, he said, "Well, of course, you think people should be blissfully happy every minute of every day." "No, I don't think that," I said. His assumption didn't surprise me, however, because I'd received similar criticism in the past. "You wrote this self-help book." "No, I wouldn't describe my book as self-help, though it is self-helpful. Many of the greatest figures in history made a study of happiness. When had the desire for self-knowledge and self-mastery become branded as self-help snake oil? I write in the tradition of Montaigne, Johnson, La Rochefoucauld, Thoreau. At least I try to. Like he cared. Well, you argue that people should aim never to experience negative emotions." "I never argue that," I answered in a weary tone. "I don't believe that." The conversation then turned to a more specific discussion of happiness and health, but I hung up the phone unsatisfied. I wished we'd argued out the subject. The aim of a happiness project is not to eliminate all forms of unhappiness from life. Given the reality of existence, as well as human nature, that's not possible. And even if it were possible, it's not desirable. Negative emotions, up to a point, can play a very helpful role in a happy life. They're powerful, flashy signs that something isn't right. They often prod me into action. The first splendid truth holds that to be happier, I have to think about feeling good, feeling bad, and feeling right in an atmosphere of growth. Feeling bad is an important element. In fact, one principal reason I started my happiness project was to eliminate bad feelings from guilt, resentment, and boredom. Guilt for losing my patience with my children. Resentment toward Jamie for his failure to award me gold stars. Boredom with activities that I thought I ought to find fun. What's more, beyond the boundaries of my personal experience, the pain of seeing others' pain incited me to take action, whether on behalf of people in my life or out in the world. Bad feelings are useful in another way as well. One key to happiness is self-knowledge, and yet it's very, very hard to know myself, especially painful aspects that I want to deny. Negative emotions highlight things I tried to conceal. For example, when I was thinking of switching careers from law to writing, the uncomfortable emotion of envy helped show me what I really wanted. When I read class notes in my alumni magazine, I felt only mild interest in most careers, including the people with interesting legal jobs. I envied the writers. Lying, too, can be an important signal. A friend told me, "I knew I had to get control of my children's TV time when I heard myself lying to the pediatrician about how much TV they watched." Another friend admitted, "In my new job, I can walk to work. I kept telling people I did walk to work, but really, I didn't. I decided I had to be honest, and then I really did start walking." Of course, as Samuel Johnson pointed out, the medicine which rightly applied has power to cure, has, when rashness or ignorance prescribes it, the same power to destroy. The bitter medicine of negative emotions can be helpful within a certain range, but if it creates severe unhappiness, or certainly depression, it can become so painful that it interferes with normal life. An important exercise for happiness, I realized, was to look for ways to eliminate the causes of unhappiness, or if that wasn't possible, to deal constructively with negative emotions and difficult situations. Within my family, it was more fun to talk to my sister about the Eleusis Project than to talk to my parents about durable powers of attorney. But both kinds of conversations had a role to play in a happy life. Whether or not we live with our family under the same roof, or whether we're even in contact with the members of our family, our relationship to our family is an influence on our happiness, for better or for worse. Adam Smith observed, "With what pleasure do we look upon a family, through the whole of which reign mutual love and esteem, where the parents and children are companions for one another, without any other difference than what is made by respectful affection on the one side and kind indulgence on the other, where freedom and fondness, mutual raillery and mutual kindness show that no opposition of interest divides the brothers, nor any rivalship of favors sets the sisters at variance, and where everything presents us